And good afternoon. You're listening to Ken Hudnall. This is the Ken Hudnall Show, coming to you from our studios right here in exciting El Paso, Texas. Gateway to the Old West and the most haunted city in the country. Well, it is October the 7th. This year is just flying by. This is the 280th day of the year. Leap year is 281st. 85 days remain till the end of the year. And this has been quite an interesting date in history. In 3761 BC, the epoch reference date or origin of the modern Hebrew calendar. 1403, Venetian-Genoese War. A Genoese fleet under a French admiral is defeated by a Venetian fleet. French were never that effective in war until Napoleon came along. 1477, Uppsala University is inaugurated after getting its corporate rights from Pope Sixtus IV in February of 1477. 1513, War of the League of Cambrai. Spain defeats Venice. 1571, the Battle of Lepanto is fought. Ottoman Navy suffers its first defeat. 1691, the Charter for the Province of Massachusetts Bay is issued. 1763, King George III issues the Royal Proclamation of 1763. Closing indigenous lands in North America, north and west of the Alleghenies to white settlement. That didn't go over that well with the power that be in North America. 1777, American Revolutionary War. Americans defeat the British in the Second Battle of Saratoga, also known as the Battle of Beamish Heights. You know, the Brits had the most powerful army in the world at that time. So for them to get handed their head by the colonists was just unheard of. 1780, American Revolutionary War. American militia defeats Royalist irregulars led by British Major Patrick Ferguson in South Carolina. 1800, French Corsair Robert Surcouf, commander of the 18-gun ship La Confiance, captures the British 38-gun the Kent. 1826, Granite Railway begins operation as the first chartered railway in the U.S. 1828, Morea Expedition. The city of Patras, Greece is liberated by the French Expeditionary Force. 1840, William II becomes King of the Netherlands. 1864, American Civil War. A U.S. Navy ship captures a Confederate raider in a Brazilian seaport. And that caused quite an international kerfuffle, let me tell you. 1868, Cornell University holds opening day ceremonies. The initial enrollment of students is 412, the highest of any American university up to that time. 1870, Franco-Prussian War. Leon Gambetta escapes the siege of Paris in a hot air balloon. 1879, Germany and Austria-Hungary sign the Twofold Covenant and create the Dual Alliance. 1912, the Helsinki Stock Exchange sees its first transaction complete. 1916, Georgia Tech defeats Cumberland University 222-0 in the most lopsided college football game in American history. 1919, KLM, the flag carrier for the Netherlands, is founded. It's the oldest airline still operating under its original name. And probably still has some of the original peanuts. 1924, Andreas Michalkopoulos becomes the Prime Minister of Greece for a short period of time. 1929, Photius II becomes the Ecumenical Patriarch of Constantinople. That was Constantinople's version of the Pope. 1933, Air France is inaugurated after being formed by a merger of five French airlines. 1940, the McCollum Memo proposes bringing the U.S. into war in Europe by provoking the Japanese to attack the United States. Now, keep in mind, there have long been stories that FDR orchestrated the attack. The McCollum Memo is also known as the 8 Action Memo. It was dated October 7, 1940, sent by Lieutenant Commander Arthur McCollum, who provided the President with intelligence reports on Japan and oversaw every intercepted and decoded Japanese military message and diplomatic report destined for the White House. He was the director of the Office of Naval Intelligence Far East Asia section. It was sent to Navy Captains Dudley Knox, who agreed with the actions described in the memo, and Walter Stratton Anderson. Now, the first time this came to light was in Robert Stennett's book, Day of Deceit, The Truth About FDR and Pearl Harbor. Now, this book alleges Franklin Roosevelt and his administration deliberately provoked and allowed the Japanese to attack Pearl Harbor. The attacking fleet was detected by radio and intelligence intercepts, but the information was withheld from Admiral Kimmel, commander of the Pacific Fleet at that time. Now, this book was released in 1999. And the New York Times, in its capacity as the most brilliant, thought-provoking newspaper in history, gave it a nuanced review. Historians of the period, though, rejected the thesis, pointing out that the great FDR wouldn't do such a thing. All right. 1944. During an uprising in Birkenau concentration camp, Jewish prisoners burned down the crematorium number 4. 1949, the Communist German Democratic Republic is formed. That's East Germany. Remember, if it's got democratic in its name, it's more than likely a communist-inspired setup. 1950, Mother Teresa establishes the Missionaries of Charity. 1958, Pakistani coup d'etat inaugurates a prolonged period of military rule. Also in 58, the U.S. manned spaceflight program is renamed Project Mercury. 1959, the Soviet probe Luna 3 transmits the first ever photographs of the far side of the moon. 1963, Kennedy signs the ratification of the Partial Nuclear Test Ban Treaty. 1977, the fourth Soviet constitution is adopted. 1985, the Mamey's landslide kills almost 200 people in Puerto Rico. 1985, four men from the Palestinian Liberation Front hijacked the MS Achille Lauro off the coast of Egypt. 1987, Sikh nationalists declared independence of Khalistan from India, though it's not internationally recognized. 1988, a hunter discovers three gray white whales trapped under the ice near Alaska. This results in a multinational effort to free the whales. 1991, Croatian War of Independence, the bombing of Banski Dvori in Zagreb, Croatia. 1993, the flood of 93 ends at St. Louis, Missouri, 103 days after it began, as the Mississippi River falls below flood stage. 1996, Fox News Channel begins broadcasting. 1998, Matthew Shepard, a gay student at the University of Wyoming, is found tied to a fence after being savagely beaten by two young adults in Laramie, Wyoming. He died 5 days later. I have to ask what it matters, what you want to get it on with. I don't care if you want to worship a pumpkin. Just don't put it in front of me. 2000, the Israeli-Pakistan conflict. Hezbollah militants captured three Israeli Defense Force soldiers in a border crossing raid. 2001, U.S. invasion of Afghanistan begins with an air assault and covert operations on the ground. 2002, the space shuttle Atlantis launches on STS-112 to continue assembly of the International Space Station. 2008, asteroid. 2008, TC-3 impacts the Earth over Sudan. First time an asteroid impact is detected prior to its entry into Earth's atmosphere. And in 2016, in the wake of Hurricane Matthew, the death toll hits 800. A lot of births and deaths on this date in history. Holidays and observances. Christian Feast Day, Justina of Padua. Henry Muhlenberg in some Lutheran churches, an Episcopal Church of the U.S. Osgeith, Our Lady of the Rosary. Pope Mark, Sergius and Bacchus. And in Laos is Teacher's Day. Well, let's see what else we have for this particular day in history. 1571, the Battle of Lepanto. Holy League of Southern European Nations destroy Ottoman fleet and a significant loss off Western Greece. 1737, a cyclone which caused 40-foot waves are believed to have killed 300,000 people in Calcutta, India. Famous birthdays, Elijah Muhammad, Heinrich Himmler, Desmond Tutu, Vladimir Putin, he's 68, and Simon Cowell. Now, let's see. 1988, Robin Givens filed for divorce after an 8-month marriage to Mike Tyson. Famous deaths, George Mason, Edgar Allan Poe, Willis Carrier, Clarence Birdseye, and Leo DeRocha. And let's see what else we may have. In 336, Pope St. Mark died, ended his reign as Catholic Pope. That was one of the few times the papacy was vacant. 1492, Christopher Columbus missed Florida when he changed course. 1506, Pope Julius II and France occupy Bologna. 1513, Battle of La Mata. Spanish troops under Ramon de Cardona defeat the Venetians. And in 1520, something that would make the left extremely proud, the first public burning of books in the Netherlands in Louvain. 1542, explorer Juan Rodriguez Cabrillo discovers Catalina Island off the coast of California. And as early as he discovered it, he still couldn't get a reservation at the Catalina Hotel. 1637, Prince Frederick Henry occupies Breda. 1690, the English attack Quebec under Louis de Bourdeille. 1702, British and Dutch troops under Marlborough occupy Raymond. 1714, people riot due to a beer tax in Alkmaar in the Netherlands. 1765, the Stamp Act Congress. That's the first Congress of the American colonies convenes in New York City to devise a unified protest against new British taxation. One of my ancestors on the Tibbs side was a leader in the revolt against the Stamp Act. 1806, carbon paper was patented in London by Ralph Wedgwood. 1816, the first double-deck steamboat, the Washington, arrives in New Orleans. 1828, the Greek city of Patras is liberated by the French expeditionary force in the Peloponnese under General Maison. 1856, Cyrus Chambers patents a folding machine that folds books and newspapers. 1915, English nurse by the name of Edith Cavell is sentenced to death along with 34 others and a German court-martial for running an underground network to free Allied soldiers. 1916, the German submarine U-53 arrives in Newport, Rhode Island, and sinks 9 British merchant ships. They made sure to sink them in international waters. 1929, Ramsay MacDonald was the first British Prime Minister to address the U.S. Congress. 1944, Field Marshal Erwin Rommel ordered to return to Berlin, the most brilliant general Hitler had, and he believed the rumors that he was a traitor. So he gave him the choice of his family to be killed or he had to shoot himself. He shot himself. 1952, the first bandstand broadcast in Philadelphia on WFIL-TV by Dick Clark. He was actually a substitute host who joined in 1955. And he made that show his own. 1952, interestingly enough, I was asked why I talk about history in the first few minutes of my show. And number one, I find history fascinating. And number two, those who don't know history are doomed to repeat it. And we've got all the problems we need right now. Now, yesterday I did a guest appearance on someone else's podcast, and I talked about the ghost of El Paso. Now, El Paso is the most haunted city in the country. It's also a place where there's been a lot of unusual activity reported. And there have been a large number of books written by scholars, much better than I, dealing with the standard accepted version of a history of El Paso and the border region. You know, some of these scholars can write and talk about Don Juan Oñate as if he's a close friend, and some speak of him as if he were a saint. I'm fairly knowledgeable about history. I wasn't enamored with Oñate and his brethren, but I have followed his adventures with some interest. He's one of the first to explore this part of the country for Spain. Now, the conquistadors, when they came to South America, wealth beyond the dreams of Midas was suddenly laid out in front of them. And it was stolen by the conquistadors, or torn from the earth by slave labor, or found in some other fashion. Much of the wealth held by the native population in the Americas, for one reason or another, was eventually buried, hidden away from the greedy Spaniards. And a substantial portion of that wealth that was found was buried or lost by the finders, whether intentionally or through misfortune. And when I began researching my first book, actually my first book was about UFOs. It was called The Occult Connection, UFO Secret Societies and Ancient Gods. And when I was forced to medically retire, I discovered video games. One afternoon, I'm sitting there enjoying myself, and my wife walks in, and she says, "Look, I'm not retired. You're not retired. Go do something." And I said, "Like what?" "Write another book." Well, I had long been interested in the history of El Paso, and I started hearing the stories about ghosts and haunted locations. So I figured, what the heck? Now, from my way of thinking, the paranormal is the flip side of history. So this first book was the history of Mr. El Paso del Norte, which was the original name of El Paso. And as I began to do that research and ask questions about many of the stories I'd heard about, I was told there was nothing unusual about El Paso. But as I continued to research, I discovered El Paso was definitely the most unusual place. For example, at one point in time in the 50s, the program being pushed by the Chamber of Commerce was come to El Paso and dig for treasure. It was 1951. And even though most people think El Paso is a forgotten corner of Texas, it's actually played a major role in some of the most enduring mysteries in Texas history. Now, in spite of all the stories about how wonderful it is in Austin and San Antonio, what's not very well known is that the beginnings of Texas history to be found in this area, what's called the Paso North. In fact, the oldest settlement in Texas was Isleta, which became part of El Paso in 1955. Now, what may confuse the issue for most people is that when Texas became a republic in 1836, the El Paso area was a part of the Mexican state of Chihuahua, and it consisted of six settlements: El Paso del Norte, San Lorenzo, Sinocu, lying on the south side of the Rio Grande, Isleta del Sur, Socorro, and San Elizario, which were located on what amounted to an island. Now, that island was created as a result of one of the many shiftings of the Rio Grande riverbed and the formation of a new channel south of these three communities. And unfortunately, even though El Paso has a very old history, mainstream scholars have paid very little attention to this forgotten corner of the state. They turn their attention to the better-known areas around Austin. As a result, even though you could fill a library of books about the history of Austin and San Antonio, the first full-length history of El Paso and the surrounding area wasn't published till 1923. Owen White wrote Out of the Desert, the historical romance of El Paso. Now, that book was printed in very limited numbers, and if you can find a copy in a used bookstore, it's going to sell for several hundred dollars. But even this literary giant concentrated on the accepted history, paid little or no attention to the more unusual aspects of El Paso's history. The stories and the legends about strange and unusual creatures and buried treasure. And it's an unfortunate fact that the First Amendment notwithstanding, censorship is routinely practiced by academics, authorities, publishers, book distributors, and even bookstores. And while the reading public may love to read about such wild topics, the critics usually turn up their collective noses about these topics, and lily-livered publishing houses scurry to please the critics by not publishing such trash, as it's called. Certainly no self-respecting scholar would even think about writing about such things as ghosts and haunted houses, such as the peer pressure in academia to deviate from the accepted history is actually a form of heresy. Now, many aspects of the accepted history of our nation, as I learned it in school, well, over 50 years ago now, has now been shown not to be the actual truth, but rather a varnished version designed to justify the sometimes less than honorable actions of the dominant power group then in power. Even something as sacred as the story of Davy Crockett dying at the Alamo surrounded by the many bodies of the Mexican soldiers he killed has now been called into question by several contemporary accounts. recently discovered accounts by eyewitnesses within the Mexican army itself told the story that Crockett and some others were overpowered and captured by Mexican soldiers and, on the orders of Santa Anna, shot by a firing squad. Then the bodies were stacked and burned about where the one of the hotels is now. As somebody who was born in Tennessee myself, just as was the Honorable Mr. Crockett, and in fact he's a distant collateral relative, I'm horrified at the thought that history misrepresented what happened to this explorer, adventurer, and warrior. But that doesn't make it any less true. For a long time, to even whisper that the legendary Davy Crockett might have been captured, or maybe. You know, as I was saying, you know, the idea that some of the defenders of the Alamo, and Davy Crockett in particular, were overpowered and captured and didn't die in the defense of the Alamo is somehow anticlimactic. And the fact that he's supposed to have surrendered, one of the Santa Ana's aides kept a diary, and he wrote in that diary about the fact that Crockett was supposed to have been captured. But, you know, these aspects of history are just as much part of our culture and just as important as in the overall scheme of things as the establishment of the first permanent settlement in the state, or the fact that Don Juan Oñate crossed the river into Texas. And I don't believe you can get a true flavor of a culture until there's an understanding and appreciation of the legends and stories that help mold the unique Anglo-Hispanic culture that you find in the border region. You know, many of the old ghost stories are retold by the elders to their children to either scare the hell out of them and make them mind or impart a message or a moral of some sort. Others, frankly, have no such mundane purpose and actually appear to have some historical basis in fact. Now, this area has been considered a, for lack of a better term, a hotbed for unidentified flying objects. For example, the 1897 airship mystery. You know, the current UFO craze got its start when a pilot by the name of Kenneth Arnold saw several flying discs cross his flight path. New Mexico had long been considered to be at the forefront of this mystery by most serious investigators, and groups such as the MUFON is very active in that state. Legends have even stated there's an underground alien base hidden in New Mexico, and the little town of Dulce, New Mexico, on the Jicarilla Apache Reservation, has been pointed out as a prime location for this hidden base. In fact, I got a video coming out about that, and there's a lot of evidence that, in fact, that story may be true. You know, over the years, according to the tabloids and hundreds of books appearing on every bookshelf in the country, there have been numerous sightings, kidnappings, and other bizarre happenings laid at the doorstep of these mysterious aliens. Unfortunately, it would seem that poor El Paso is so out of the way that even space aliens avoid it. Or do they? El Paso's involvement in mysterious flying objects actually goes back into the 1800s, long predating Kenneth Arnold's famous sighting. In the months of April and May of 1897, something very unusual was going on in the state of Texas. 6 years before the Wright brothers would get their flying machine off the ground, a strange cigar-shaped flying object was seen from the Red River as far south as the Gulf of Mexico and as far west as the Rio Grande. Witnesses speculated the craft may have actually been a meteor or a star or a sign from God or even a visitor from another planet. Then there's the stories that an unknown genius had solved the problem of flight. And, of course, the naysayers popped up and said the whole thing was just a hoax. Now, these questions were never really answered because after cruising around for 2 months, the airship sailed off into history and left behind an unsolved mystery. And that mystery even involved El Paso. Apparently, the mysterious vehicle spent some time here. On April 15, 1897, a man by the name of Robert Hitch said he and his family saw a bright light north of El Paso traveling at a high rate of speed heading to the northwest. Now, at that particular point in history, there were no known aircraft of any type, and even lighter-than-air balloons were a rarity. Certainly, there was nothing at this time made by man that could fly at any rate of speed, much less a high rate. And according to Mr. Hitch, several other local El Pasoans saw the light, and all were certain at watching this mysterious airship that had been talked about in the news. Now, Mr. Hitch went so far as to send his story to the Bloomington, Illinois Daily Dispatch, rather than the local newspaper, so of course he immediately pissed off all the powers that be here. The story has never mentioned any local Texas paper since it first been published in a Yankee paper. Such was the power of local politics in that less than enlightened age. But perhaps I shouldn't say that because some of the same things happen today. Now, the next involvement of El Paso in this mystery wasn't a direct one, but the pilot of the mysterious craft told others he'd been in El Paso, which does tend to confirm Mr. Hitch's story. And since all descriptions held that the pilot of that mysterious craft was a human being, how would one know that the person in line in front of him at a grocery store is really the one that was flying about the country chasing, causing chaos and confusion? Then there's the story told by Major Donahue, one of a group of domino players who had their game interrupted in Conroe, Texas by the mysterious airship. He reported that three pilots he talked to said they were traveling from San Francisco to Cuba by way of Conroe, El Paso, and New Orleans. And they told him they'd stopped in Conroe for dinner to break the monotony of flying about the countryside. After having a nice dinner and some kibitzing of the strategy being employed in the domino game, according to the major, they got back into their machine and flew off on their mysterious mission. Then we have John Barkley of Rockland, Texas, reporting that the night of April 22, 1897, an oblong-shaped aircraft with a bright light and wings circled his farm and came to a landing, which of course upset the farm dogs, not to mention Mr. and Ms. Barkley. Well, as most Texans did in those days, Mr. Barkley and his trusty Winchester went out to meet the pilot. And he said later that the pilot was an ordinary-looking young man who assured him that he meant no harm by landing so close to the house. He gave Mr. Barkley a $10 bill and asked him to run an errand and get him some lubricating oil and a couple of cold chisels and some bluestone. Excuse me. Now, Barkley was able to get the oil and the chisels, but not the bluestone. When he got back, the pilot thanked him, told him to keep the change, and he'd one day return to take Mr. Barkley on a ride in the airship as a repayment for his kindness. Then, as usually happened, he got back into the mysterious machine and flew off into the heavens. Last report, Mr. Barkley never got his ride. Now, this time, El Paso was a mere stopover, but there have been other encounters much more definitive than the involvement in the mystery of the 1897. And these questions apparently bothered others in El Paso. The El Paso Herald Post, a now-defunct newspaper in El Paso, in 1974 had a story that was headlined, 1897 UFO in El Paso stirred questions. According to this article, Texas was astir last May with echoes of an 1897 air crash. Was it a UFO? Was an unearthed creature killed in the crash? Well, the investigation by the International UFO Bureau started in June of 1972. And a Dallas newspaper published a study last spring and drew some national attention. Now Hayden C. Hughes, the Bureau director, published a report concluding what happened in Aurora, Texas in 1897 had not yet been determined. But he did say evidence indicates that the people in and around Aurora were observing something which persons across the U.S. were also observing. Now, El Paso was one of the places where people saw strange things in the sky, according to the Herald of April 20th, 1897. And a drawing illustrates the account of the strange airship whose appearance was described by a man whose name the Herald was forbidden to use. Now, it was detailed as the same vehicle that had created so much talk around the country for some weeks, according to that account. The man says he was, the reporter said he was lying on a pallet on the ground in the eastern part of town at about 2 o'clock. Hadn't gone to sleep, he was scanning the sky, looking for nothing in particular, and all of a sudden he saw what he thought at first was a very bright star appear in the east. But it appeared to be moving rapidly and became brighter. Then he thought it might be a meteor, but it was moving very steadily, directly toward town. And then it dawned on him. He was looking at the airship about which he'd been reading in the Dallas News, and he watched that object very closely. It came close to where he was lying and didn't seem to be more than 500 feet in the air. He didn't make any noise. He listened intently, and he could hear voices as if two or more people were talking. As the airship passed over him, its course was changed, and it rose to a higher altitude. Its speed was considerably slackened, and for over an hour it soared over the city, going in all directions. It seemed to be looking for something. After a while, it started off south in the direction of Chihuahua and was lost to sight. Now, he said the ship was about 40 to 60 feet long, cigar-shaped, with a tremendous strong searchlight in the front and in the back. Rays of bright light streamed from portholes on the sides. And on each side of the ship, he said, was a large wing-shaped contrivance. At each end was a large propeller turning in furious velocity on top of what appeared to be several fast-moving propellers. The man who reported it, the Herald said, assured he hadn't been drinking and studied the ship closely. Another person said he'd been, had seen it, but refused to discuss it when questioned by reporters. The UFO Bureau's research found that metal described as fragments of the spaceship was nothing more than iron. And several witnesses who had been quoted in the press as verifying the airship's story later told the Bureau they'd been misquoted. Well, the research was augmented, though, by reports from several people who had personal or family recollections of strange sightings during that period. Some metal identified as being from the Aurora crash site was analyzed as tin-plated low-carbon steel, wrought iron, zinc, cast alloy, and antimonial lead. According to Hughes, who wrote a story for Beyond Reality magazine, whether the Herald was serious in its report about the spaceship, of course, is open to question. On April 24, 1897, the paper reported the airship is still knocking around the atmosphere, lately been seen down in Louisiana. Would have probably stopped over at El Paso and taken a rest, but heard that the lawyers in the contested election cases were about to argue the question, and as the airship was just out for trial, the owners didn't care to have the ship stay in this atmosphere until it had become purified again. At that point in time, El Paso was in the midst of a political dispute, which seems to be kind of the state of affairs, not only for El Paso, but for the country. Now, El Paso's airship may not have been the same one seen over Dallas, though the Herald account indicates that it looked like the same. Dallas Morning News of April 18, 1897 related the airship had crashed into a windmill the day before at Aurora, Texas, and the pilot, who was not of this world, would be buried the next day. Last July, news reports indicated the pilot's UFO grave had been robbed of the skeleton and whatever had been buried with it. When the whole thing began back in 1897, a lot of people thought the Dallas news stories were a hoax. When it was revived, the same kind of question set in. Though several denials of reports were turned up by the UFO Bureau, a number of other accounts of strange flying objects and strange fires did turn up. U.S. astronauts reported unidentified flying objects during their missions. Gordon Cooper said that UFOs under intelligent control have visited our planet for thousands of years. So was it really an airship crash in Aurora? Was an airship seen over El Paso? Some say no, but there's a lot of others that say yes. And there are many who just wonder what people were seeing back in 1897. Well, there's no doubt that the UFOs continue to visit the city. But the question is, what are they doing? We don't really know for sure. Now, we also have a story from 1965. Members of the J.M. Hillen family at 533 Barcelona Drive were wondering if anybody else saw a strange flying object that they sighted in the skies of southern New Mexico. The group, which consisted of 12 adults and 4 children, were seated in a circle while camped out at Hot Springs Landing near Elephant Butte Lake. They were scanning the skies to pick out familiar stars in the patch of the Milky Way. They said the night was unusually clear. Suddenly, Mr. Hillen said they saw the object moving at great speed, coming from the east and going to the west. He said it was white and shining and appeared to be a very large star. When it got to a point almost directly over the group, though, it exploded without noise, broke into 2 pieces, it turned red. A huge cloud of vapor formed around them. The red object continued onward to the eastern horizon and out of sight. A few minutes later, the family heard a tremendous explosion, and then they heard a second one shortly after that. Members of the group conjectured the flying object might have been an old satellite re-entering the Earth's atmosphere and burning up as it came. Now, whether or not you believe in UFOs, it would appear that our military believes in these things, even though they don't openly admit it, though recently they have. And this covert interest in a strange and unusual occurrence has given rise to a mountain of books and a number of TV shows. And in this following story from the El Paso Times, which also dates to 1964. Fort Bliss authorities believe movie films by a 14-year-old El Paso boy last week show a space object. Jack Spiro, son of Mr. and Ms. Nathan Spiro of 3301 North Campbell Street, took moving pictures last Thursday afternoon after spotting the flying objects. The films that were sent to Dallas were returned Tuesday and taken to Fort Bliss for viewing. Spiro was picked up at El Paso Technical High School Tuesday morning by military personnel to go see the films. After putting the films through high-power microscopic lens, the films reveal pictures of a dark ivory V object with a semicircle on top. According to Spiro, it definitely is an object. At least that's what he said the military told him, who immediately prepared a report for the Pentagon official in Washington. Films are placed in a safety deposit box in a local bank. Washington thinks they're useful, officials will send for them, Spiro said. Of course, there are those in El Paso who've had much closer encounters with these mysterious flying objects. We have another article that also came from April of 1964. The headline was Lakeside Woman Scared by a Bouncing Saucer. According to the story, El Paso today had its first flying saucer scare of the spring season. Numerous sightings have been reported from New Mexico. Mrs. R.R. Reyes of 327 Vivian Drive in Lakeside said she spotted a bright, shiny object looking like an inverted dish plate hovering over her home this morning about 10:15 a.m. When interviewed, Ms. Reyes said it scared the hell out of me. Said, I was just about to sit down and look at my favorite television show, and I glanced out the window to see what the weather was like, and I saw this bright aluminum thing up about as high as a telephone pole. She said it really caught the light. At that distance, it appeared to be about the size of a living room drum table, but I believe it was really much bigger, although it was smaller than an airplane. Ms. Reyes said the object remained stationary for a few minutes, bounced up and down like a top, and slowly arose into the air toward Escarte Lake. She said it made no sound at all. On first sighting the object, Ms. Reyes called to her niece, Estella Reyes, and her 6-year-old daughter, Elizabeth, to come and look. She said they both saw the flying object in the air. According to Ms. Reyes, it looked like a dish plate upside down and spun away just like a plate would spin if you flung it into the air. Carried a light on the bottom, bright light. She said, I'm really surprised. I never expected to see anything like that around here. My husband and I talked about the thing the people saw in New Mexico, and I didn't think I'd ever see anything like that. I'm still shaking, she said. Several small planes were in the air at the time of Ms. Reyes' report, but she insisted the object she saw was not an airplane. So it would appear that the UFO nauts have discovered El Paso, or maybe Ms. Reyes did see a plane or something that only looked like a flying dish plate. But flying saucer, plane, or something else, what was the object searching for at Escarte Lake? We'll probably never know, but I have in my collection another story that I think came from the El Paso Herald Post. The principals in the story also saw something unusual over Escarte Park. Was it a coincidence? Was there something in the park area the pilots were frantically searching for but couldn't find? This next story, the headline is Couple Say They Saw a UFO Over El Paso. According to the story, a Juarez couple claims they saw an unidentified flying object, or an OVNI as they're called in Mexico, over El Paso Saturday night near Escarte Park. El Fronterizo, a Juarez newspaper, Wednesday published accounts of the UFOs told by Mr. and Mrs. Pablo Arias Ramirez, who reside in Calzada Hermosas Escobar. The couple reported they saw the sky light up about 9:15 p.m. with what they thought was a big star. They said it was brilliant with yellow, red, and blue lights, and later it disappeared high into the sky. They described this object as rectangular, not circular, like a flying saucer. The couple reportedly told the newspaper that the brilliant object dropped down when the airplane from El Paso International Airport flew to it. El Paso Air Control Tower officials reported they had not seen anything unusual on that particular day, but that is kind of standard responses that you'll get from the air traffic controllers. Officials at the Federal Aviation Authority said they had no reports of strange activity in the air over El Paso on Sunday night. And as might be expected, even though no one in the authority had a clue as to what was taking place, as soon as the report was made public, scientists had to get their hands into the mystery in order to be able to see their names in print. That seemed to be all the scientists were able to accomplish because they certainly never came up with any type of explanation for the sighting. Well, in addition to UFOs, I mean, there's no question they've discovered El Paso, and they appear to be landing and scaring the hell out of the residents, especially as equally as scary to some segments of the El Paso community, the bizarre beliefs of the groups that tend to gravitate to these publicized sightings. Historically, there have been many things seen in the skies of El Paso, to include the mythical Thunderbird. The stories and ancient legends told by the early Spanish explorers and the many Indian tribes in which they came in contact during their travels were to be believed. Truth is certainly stranger than fiction. Maybe El Paso isn't the staid, normal, boring town that many consider it to be. You know, flying saucers, space aliens, channeled wise elders are not the only stories I found during the research for my books. There were a number of stories of buried treasure and lost civilizations that would have whetted the appetites of a boatload of adventurers. I've been an amateur treasure hunter for, over 40 years and own one of the top of the line metal detectors currently on the market. I've talked to many of the local treasure hunters, of whom there are more than a few, and I was disappointed to learn that as far as they were aware, there were no lost or buried treasures in the immediate El Paso area at all. Now, if I wanted to go to New Mexico, or into Mexico, or into the Big Bend country, I was assured there were lost treasures aplenty that men had searched for over the years. But unfortunately, in El Paso, nobody had ever hidden anything here. More than one member of the El Paso Prospectors Club told me very emphatically there were no lost or buried treasures in this area. Well, as I researched my first book, I discovered that, in fact, El Paso can claim to be the home of a number of lost treasure stories, some of which have roots solidly linked in history. Any one of the treasures I discovered were buried in and around El Paso would be enough to support a lucky finder into a ripe old age. Now, I've had been given many stories of lost treasures along the Rio Grande, but I wasn't able to find much information on the subject printed until I came across the story of the Rio Grande treasure. Now, this particular story came out of a magazine called Treasure Tales of the Old West, and as with many treasure stories from the Southwest, a treasure which actually may exist is associated with a ghost who seems to be the guardian of that lost treasure. Hand in hand with many of these stories are superstitions that also work to protect the treasure from would-be finders. One of the stories I heard that I found fascinating involved the superstitious belief the ghost of a dead priest guards the treasure and hunt down anybody who takes it. And that story led two boys in the 1920s to walk away. Actually, they ran. Wealth that would have given their family a much better life. Now, according to this old story told by the widow of one of the finders, somewhere between Socorro and Cabello, are the ruins of an old village and an old adobe church. During the early decades of the 1900s, there were a number of deserted communities to be found along the Rio Grande. And inside the ruined church in this particular community is supposed to be a treasure that would allow the lucky finder to become a member of the Idle Rich. According to the author of the story, the two boys stepped cautiously over the fallen and rotting beams inside the crumbling walls of an old adobe church beside the Rio Grande. A rabbit they were chasing had scuttled through a gaping hole that had once held heavy doors. They saw it dive under the remains of an old viga near the former church altar. Well, the younger boy was scared and didn't really want to go in, but the older boy, I guess you could say, he kind of pushed him. He said, "That old bootlegger was just trying to scare us off. There's no ghost here." So they began moving the rotting boards under the viga. They were going to get that rabbit because in the 20s, bringing home a rabbit could be the difference between eating and not eating for many. Well, as he moved the boards, he certainly jerked back like he uncovered a rattlesnake. And he gasped to his brother, "We found it." And the younger boy said, "The rabbit?" He said, "It's really here, the old priest buried treasure." Well, the treasure was actually there. From where they were at, they could see into what was clearly a small basement. There were several silver candlesticks, a golden chalice, small blocks of yellow and gray metal, and silver crosses attached to strings of beads. All of it nestled in the remains of church vestments. Well, the older boy grabbed his brother and said, "Let's get out of here." And they started to run, but the older boy stopped and said, "Wait a minute, let's cover it back up." So he went back and, with shaking hands, replaced the rubble and the rotting viga over the hidden treasure. Then they ran as fast as they could. They ran until they were exhausted and hid in a grove of cottonwoods on the riverbank. The older boy told the younger one, "Don't ever tell anybody about this. Don't say a word. We don't want that old priest haunting and catching us." He said, "I thought that old bootlegger was just trying to scare us, but actually the treasure is there." Well, the story the boys had been told went back to the 1870s. In those days, keep in mind, this side of the river was Comanche territory. And they were so deadly, even the Apaches were afraid of them. So a lot of small villages had grown up. And whenever there was danger of a Comanche attack, everybody would bring their valuables to the church for the priest to hide. And then they'd go hide. Well, in one particular raid, many of the villagers were killed, including the priest of the church. But before he was killed, he had managed to hide the Eucharistic vessels, gold and silver bars, and vestments of the church, and all everything brought to him by the villagers. Well, it was during the early 1920s, two boys found the church treasure. The ghost of the priest, murdered by Indians over 50 years before, was said to haunt the crumbling ruins to frighten away anybody who might want to take the hidden gold and silver valuables. And the old man had told him the story. A supposed bootlegger who lived near the completely deserted remnants of the village declared he and his family had seen the ghost many times. As he described it, the spirit of the long-dead priest, draped in long flowing robes, wandered in seeming sadness around the church and in the cemetery. On still mornings, he said, the priest could be heard very clearly intoning early mass. And the man's wife and daughter confirmed what the father said. So this was the story that instilled awe and fear within the minds of two boys after they accidentally discovered the treasure. They were afraid either to disturb it further or to tell anybody else the location. Now, the older boy, name was Clyde Simpson, grew up, and the person that wrote the story married Clyde, and the younger boy, Bob Simpson, married the sister. Audrey Simpson was the name of the writer who wrote the book Rio Grande Treasure. And on many occasions, Clyde told the story about the treasure. He talked about stacks of yellow and gray metal under the candlesticks. And, of course, by the time he got to be an adult, he knew there were bars of gold and silver. Clyde recalled that while the family lived in San Marcial during the 20s, he and Bob and your older brother Glenn were often went on camping and fishing trips along the Rio Grande. They'd stay out several days at a time. One of these outings turned out to be the treasure trip, as he called it, when they came across the deserted village of about 20 decaying houses. Only family they saw for miles around was that of the old man they thought was a bootlegger and who told them the story about the murdered priest. Clyde tried to go back once while still living in San Marcial. He was riding a rather wild horse on that particular trip. When he got within sight of the crumbling walls of the church, the horse spooked and threw him. Clyde hurt his back. He said, "I was lucky some folks across the river saw what happened. They came over and carried me for miles to their house and took care of me until I was able to go back to San Marcial. And my mother sent me to California to Bible school to keep me out of trouble and never got back to the treasure." 1929, the Rio Grande went on a rampage, destroying, washing away, or covering with sand and mud a number of river villages. The Simpson home in San Marcial, where the boy's father was employed by the railroad, was covered with silt. Family lost most of its belongings in the flood, and shortly after that, they left the area. After Clyde became an ordained minister in Los Angeles, he planned to go back and hunt for the village and the treasure, but something always prevented the trip. 1940, Bob and Audrey's brother, Ed Clements, traveled down in Rio Grande in search of the village. According to what the two reported, after hunting along that river for miles, they discovered that what the roaring water hadn't washed away, the conservation district had leveled and ditched with big machinery until they couldn't find a sign where the old village sat. Clyde himself was making tentative plans to try once more to locate the treasure he had found as a young teenager when he suffered a heart attack and died in 1965. Audrey said she never knew whether the old village was above or below San Marcial, because Clyde never said. Between Socorro and Cabello, along the Rio Grande River in New Mexico, lies a buried village with its buried church. And within that village, more secure than ever in its tomb of mud and silt, lies a hidden treasure of the old church. Now, the story, if it is true, is further proof that El Paso area is one of many hidden secrets. It wouldn't be difficult for somebody to get an old map of the area between Socorro and Cabello and see if there once existed an old village that was bulldozed in 1929 as part of the flood control program. The enterprising individual that follows up on these secrets could become a very wealthy man. And there are hundreds of other lost treasure stories known to the older residents of this area that certainly I haven't come across yet. You know, along with the stories told by the older members of El Paso about Akeem's ransom and lost treasure, the area around El Paso is also home to El Muerto, a name that means the dead one, or the dead man. I heard many warnings if El Muerto caught you out at night, he'd pull you onto his back stallion and take you on a ride to hell. To the modern mind, of course, stories such as this aren't true, and they're just made up to scare little children. But the story of El Muerto is a common Mexican folktale of a beheaded man who rides his horse through the desert. The mysterious rider carries his head either in his lap or hung on a rawhide thong from the saddle horn. This was a story that Dr. John West, a professor at the University of Texas in El Paso, told. It involved a man and his wife buying a house on the outskirts of Anthony, Texas, which sits astride the Texas-New Mexico border. According to the story, this married couple bought an old house just outside of Anthony, and it was all too common in most communities. Each night, the man would go out drinking with his friends, leaving his wife at home. And one night, home alone as usual, the woman heard a noise and thought it might be her husband coming back early, so she steps outside the house and saw a headless man wearing a black cape riding a black horse across a wooden bridge near their home. And on that note, we're going to have to end it for tonight, but I'll be back talking more about the ghost of El Paso and lost and hidden treasure. Till then, Ken Hudnall for the Ken Hudnall Show saying have a truly great evening.